established director of fine documentaries, started an omnibus program of short films from around the world. My contribution would be films about Japan. I made three documentaries, one about the Japanese army, one about the life of a worker at the Yamaha motorcycle factory, and one, which I've already mentioned, about the training of an elevator girl in a department store in Osaka. My crew consisted of a cameraman and a sound man. I had help with the editing from an old hand in Japanese TV. We would spend whole nights on getting the 15-minute movie just right. The most successful of the three movies, or at least the one that remains most vividly in my memory, was the third one, about the elevator girl. The department store was one of the biggest and smartest in Osaka, the kind of store where the customer would be greeted in the morning by a straight row of uniformed women standing by the door, bowing and smiling and lisping words of welcome. The elevator girls, heavily made up and lipsticked, dressed in red and cream skirt suits, shiny white shoes and red caps with a little black feather, were perfectly drilled. They bowed as one entered the elevator, pointed up and down with their white-gloved right hands at precisely the right angles, and announced the specialties of each floor in well-trained falsetto voices. They were human dolls, as artificial as the puppets in the Bunraku Theatre for which Osaka is famous. There was not one gesture or sound in their elevator performance that had not been honed to the highest perfection. I wanted to get on film exactly how this was done. I could have chosen any of Japan's large department stores. All of them had elevator girls, dressed in the distinct uniforms of their company. The reason I picked the one in Osaka is that I'd seen a photograph of a bowing machine. Someone at this store had invented a contraption that could train a woman to make a bow at precisely 45 degrees. The machine looked a bit like a large scale, but it had a breastplate. As the person pressed against the steel plate, a moving arrow marked the degree of the bow. It could also be set for 15 degrees, an appropriate angle for a more casual encounter, or 30 degrees, the proper angle applied to customers leaving the store. We got to film the use of the machine, as well as the training sessions where the falsetto voices announcing the fourth floor for women's wear and children's toys, or the tenth for pottery, household items and art galleries, were practiced. Since the movie was shot over a period of several months, we could follow the training of one girl, named Yamada Hiroko, from start to finish. She would go through a remarkable transformation, not just from the start of her training to the moment she picked up her elevator girl license at the public ceremony at the end, but one that was repeated every day. Hiroko would arrive in the morning wearing jeans, chatting happily to her friends, giggling and chewing gum. She was an animated young woman who liked to laugh, but as soon as practice began, her face would be drained of all expression and become mask-like. Her voice would rise, and her bodily movements become as stylized as those of a no-dancer. At first, I must confess, I watched this spectacle with the sniggering attitude of a typical Westerner, reaching for the clichéd image of Japanese as human robots. But Hiroko was very far from being a robot. Hers was a performance, and she took pride in it. I asked her in front of the camera why she had decided to become an elevator girl. She cocked her head and thought for a while, and then answered in one word, akogare. It is a word people use for something they yearn for or dream about, as in akogare no Paris, Paris of our dreams. Young fans use precisely that word when they talk about the all-female Takudazuka Theatre. The aesthetic of the human doll is of course the opposite of Karajuro's idea of the privilege of the flesh. The frenzy of his actor's bodily movements is a deliberate rebellion against the controlled beauty of the living bonsai that is part of the Japanese tradition. But his physical revolt, the dancing and fighting and face-pulling and spitting and screaming on stage, is in fact just as much part of a Japanese tradition. It is the tradition of early kabuki, the riverside beggars, the riotous Shinto festivals, the student demos in Shinjuku, and the revolt of the body in Hijikata's dance. Both traditions are stylized. They are two sides of the same aesthetic coin. In 1978, a year after I translated Mask of the Virgin, Karas suddenly called me. He had something to tell me. I should come over right away. As I walked into the studio above Kara and Ree's house, some of the actors were smiling at me as though they knew something I didn't. We sat down in a circle as Kara explained the concept of his next play. It was to be called Unicorn Monogatari, Tale of the Unicorn, Taitoku version. Taitoku was the name of the Shitamachi ward where Kara was born. The play involved a labyrinth in Shitaya, his old neighborhood, and pork cutlets flying through the air, and a drag queen who raises a boy who was swapped in the Shitaya hospital for a girl, and a dog god and men from a company dealing in baby swaddlers who fight over a plastic bag containing a placenta, and Sergeant Yokoi, the Imperial Army soldier who hid in the jungle of Guam until 1972, thinking the war was not yet over. The boy who was swapped in the Shitaya hospital as a baby was called Tessio, the Italian name for Theseus, and the girl was Adone, or Ariadne. And they drank each other's blood, and she would lead him through the labyrinth with a ball of thread, all the way to Narnia, the imaginary land in the Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis, while Tessio waved his wooden sword and pulled a bicycle with a unicorn's horn bolted to the handlebars. I listened and nodded and understood nothing. "And you," said Kara with a high-pitched chuckle, "you will be in the play. You will be Iwan the Gaijin, who might be a Russian, but who claims to be the Midnight Cowboy." Chapter 9. Plot is perhaps not the main point of Kara's plays. I still don't really know what the tale of the unicorn was all about. Rather than addressing the story directly, Kara talked around the play and its associations, which always came back to his childhood. I asked him once whether he ever went to see Kabuki. The answer was that he didn't. No doubt, he said, Kabuki is somewhere buried in my subconscious. His most vivid memories of theatre were of quite another kind. He often recalled the striptease theatres in Asakusa near his home in Shitaya. In between acts, to give the girls time to change into another scanty costume, comedians would do short sketches, comic sword fights and the like, lasting no longer than 5 or 10 minutes. Some of the punters, who'd come to see the girls, would take that time to look over the horse racing results. But Kara was fascinated by these short bursts of slapstick between displays of naked flesh. "Mitikin," Kara said in his excited half-whisper, "at the casino theatre. An alcoholic vaudevillian. He did the most amazing things. After locking swords with another comic on stage, Mitikin would rush out of the theatre to the Asakusa temple and rush back in again to resume the sword fight. I once visited him in his dressing room. He was munching rice crackers from a plastic bag. His shabby suit was covered in bits of cracker, and there were crackers all over the floor too, which the girls crushed under their high heels. Suddenly Mitikin said, 'Listen, do you hear the sound of a snowstorm in the forest?'" This rather puzzling anecdote hinted at something important in the way Kara viewed the world. The shabby ambience of striptease theatres in Asakusa, the eccentricity of the sad old comedian, but above all, that sudden switch from the literal to the simile, which often involves switches from low culture to high. The squalid absurdities of Kara's childhood world, the quarrelling drag queens, the petty criminals, the sordid murder stories, the hookers, are woven into his own version of ancient myths. Ariadne helping Theseus to escape from the labyrinth in Tokyo Stamachi, looking for C.S. Lewis's Narnia. Characters, too, metamorphose in unexpected ways. The old drag queen Oharu, who swapped babies in the maternity hospital, suddenly pops up as Sergeant Yokoi, the man who hid from the world for 28 years. Kara's plays unfold with the logic, or lack of logic, of dreams. In short, there was nothing especially strange about my role as Iwan the Gaijin, who might be a Russian but claims to be the Midnight Cowboy. My appearance in a ridiculous leather cowboy hat was quite short. In the third act, I was chased onto the stage by a marching band of the Narnia Volunteer Corps. The managing director of the baby swaddlers factory, who was also the dog god Yatsufusa, played by Kobayashi Kaoru, called me a Russian. I said I wasn't a Russian. Who cares, he yelled. All white people look alike. Whereupon, pedantically, I tried to explain that the white race could be divided into Germanic people or Slavic. Enough, shouted the dog god. From the point of view of the Peking man, you're all bloody foreigners. You're a spy. Whereupon I cried out, I am the Midnight Cowboy. And so on it went for a while, with more jokes about Russians who had stolen Japanese territories in the Pacific after the war, and American GIs handing out chewing gum, a memory of which most people of Kara's age would retain from the post-war occupation. The point was, of course, not to ridicule foreigners. The joke was on common Japanese attitudes to gaijin. I was immensely flattered to be in Kara's play. It made me feel accepted as one of the gang. Perhaps it even signified that I had some talent in the playwright's eyes. Here at last was real immersion in a small wet corner of Japanese society. One night, after rehearsal, we went on one of those nocturnal excursions to Shinjuku. It was a balmy night in early spring when the neon lights blinked like stars over streets that were dense and warm with traffic and crowds. We ended up in one of Kara's favourite haunts, a small bar popular with writers called, if I remember well, Nadia, after André Breton's surrealist novel about a love affair with a madwoman. The lighting was low, the tables black, the room fogged with cigarette smoke. Miles Davis was playing softly in the background. It was a jolly evening. Bottles of whiskey were drained at a fast pace. I was seated next to Kara at his table, a place normally reserved for a senior member of the group. He looked every inch the boss, dressed in a powder blue blazer and red silk tie, ordering more drinks all around, his eyes reduced to tiny slits like a big contented cat. Most people called me by my first name, pronounced Iwan, as it was in the play. Someone said, Iwan the Terrible. Someone else said, Iwan the Gaijin. No, said a third person, Iwan the Henna Gaijin, the weird foreigner, the foreigner, that is, who can speak Japanese, and who doesn't act like a stereotypical gaijin. I laughed, but I wasn't sure I liked the phrase. However well meant, it smacked a little of admiring a trained poodle for his adorable tricks. Near the end of the evening, I found myself in the men's room standing next to Nezu, who played Tessio in Tale of the Unicorn. He turned his handsome Tokyo James Dean face toward me while I was concentrating on the white porcelain wall and said, "You know, you can only really act in our plays if you are a Japanese." I asked him what he meant. "Well," he said, "you can't act as a foreigner if you are a gaijin." I muttered something in disagreement, but his words stayed with me. I thought of the onagata in kabuki plays, the men specializing in female roles. Real women can't act these roles in the same stylized way. To get something of the flavor, women would have to play men playing women. I was a weird gaijin, supposed to play a Japanese acting as a foreigner. Perhaps that is what Nezu had meant to say. He may have been right. At least that is how it felt to me sometimes. Tale of the Unicorn would be performed in the Red Tent, of course. Our first stop on the tour was Osaka. The tent would be pitched on a grimy, concreted hill in a park overlooking the city's main zoo. Then we would move on to a riverbank in Kumamoto, an old castle town on the southwestern island of Kyushu. And from there to Kyoto and finally back to Tokyo, where we would perform on a sooty spot between the railway lines near Ikebukuro Station. The whole run would last for almost a month. Before we left, I was taken by one of the actors, Fuwa Mansaku, to meet the editor of the Asahi Graph, the now-defunct weekend supplement magazine of the Asahi newspaper. The idea was for me to take photographs of our tour and write an article about it. The editor, a lanky, long-haired hipster type in a dark grey suit, was very keen, he said, to get the gaijin's view. He might even have used the common phrase used in media circles at the time, when a person like myself was commissioned to write something, Japan seen through blue eyes. I was overjoyed. Not only would I be one of the gang, but here was a chance to show that I had some talent, not only in my cameo appearance as the Midnight Cowboy, but as a writer and photographer. No longer just a film student spy or weird gaijin voyeur, but a person of substance, even if my eyes were not of the purest blue. We set off early in the morning in a comfortable minibus, followed by a truck carrying the folded red tent. Kara and Ree were sitting near the front of the bus, chatting with Nedza, Kaoru and other senior actors. We passed through the bland suburbs of Yokohama in the dusky green tea fields near Mount Fuji, whose cone was shrouded in fluffy white clouds. After a couple of hours at some point between Toyohashi and Nagoya, I secluded myself in a window seat and started reading a book. I think it was a Dickens novel, David Copperfield, perhaps. I like reading such books on trips through Japan or other parts of Asia. Jane Austen on a train to the northeast of Thailand, or Evelyn Waugh on a bus to the south of Taiwan. It was a way, I suppose, of escaping for a short while into an imaginary world that was reassuringly familiar. I was woken from my immersion in David Copperfield's world of Steerforth and Mr. Micawber by a voice in my ear. It was the buck-toothed Fua Mansaku. "Why are you reading a book?" he asked. "You're not really used to travelling in a group, are you?" He did not say this unkindly, but it was a rebuke of sorts. One was supposed to join in, take part, share the experience of a common enterprise. To fall asleep on the bus was permissible, but reading a book was to shut oneself off from the others and clearly not done. I hastily put Uriah Heep and Betsy Trotwood out of my mind and turned back to the real world of sitting with Kara and his players, drinking green tea from plastic containers, laughing at stories about old memories I could not share, and chewing on stringy bits of pale dried octopus on the highway to Osaka. Tennoji Park, where we set up the tent after drilling holes in the rock-hard ground, is a remarkable spot. On one side is the zoo, so while rehearsing the story of a Japanese Theseus and Ariadne, threading their way through Kara's native Shitaya in search of a lost mother's placenta carried in a gory plastic bag, we could hear the chattering of monkeys and the roar of a rather mangy lion moodily pacing up and down in his confinement. On the other side of the park is an area called Shinsekai, or New World, a wonderfully seedy entertainment district, half nightlife area, half amusement park, built in 1912, inspired vaguely by a fantastical idea of New York and Paris. There's a broken-down lunar park, a tower bearing a cursory resemblance to the Eiffel Tower, and rows of cheap restaurants specializing in plebeian delicacies such as grilled chicken gizzard and pig's heart. After World War II, the once modern New World became a slum run by the Yakuza. Hoodlums in shiny suits and white patent leather shoes swaggered through its narrow alleys, frightening respectable folks away. Down and outs came flocking from all over Japan to the skid row nearby, rather like Sanya in Tokyo, where the more robust men were handed out day jobs by Yakuza contractors, if they were lucky. If not, they would get drunk on a cheap potato liquor called shochu. Along with the eateries offering grilled intestines, there were still some old music halls left, where washed-up comics wasted their tired jokes on a small number of snoring bums. The New World was also a magnet for drag queens and whores fishing for johns who were too drunk to bother about gender distinctions. So here was a distinguished guest actor in our troupe named Tokita Fujio, playing the part of Oharu, the drag queen, made up in chalky white powder with a smear of lipstick across his mouth and a red rose stuck in his woolly black wig, while some of the creatures lolling about outside our tent looked far more extraordinary. There were middle-aged men in tattered long dresses. Some sported vinyl miniskirts, their scarred skinny legs tottering on stiletto heels. The female prostitutes, too, were mostly on the elderly side, wearing similar get-ups to the men in drag. I noticed a man slashing at bits of windswept paper with his blunted metal samurai sword. Someone told me that he fancied himself as Kunisada Chuji, a legendary 19th-century swordsman and gambler. No one spoke to him, and he ignored everyone around him, absorbed in his private dream world of outlaw derring-do. He was there every morning, and sometimes in the evenings too, striking martial poses and cutting down imaginary enemies. The dress rehearsal did not go well. Kaoru had a sore throat, lines were fluffed, the pacing was wrong, Lighting cues were missed. Kara was nervous and made some of us rehearse our scenes again. But all was fine on the first night. My line about being the midnight cowboy got a huge cheer. "Feels good, doesn't it?" Fua Mansuku whispered to me in the wings. But the biggest applause came at the end of the play, when the back of the tent opened up, revealing a red excavator truck with a power shovel that scooped up Tessio and Oharu, while the music swelled and Tessio cried out, "Go, unicorn!" It was perhaps the best performance of the tour. Before returning to the Buddhist temple, where we all slept on the large tatami floor in the main hall at the foot of gilded wooden bodhisattvas, we repaired to an old-fashioned public bathhouse, frequented mostly by tired men returning from the construction sites. On the wall was a splendid mosaic of the boy Kintaro riding an orange carp, a familiar image I'd seen on Horibun's tattoos. We all shared the communal bath, of course, like rugby players immersed in the same scalding water, our red faces enveloped in steam. In the large temple hall, before laying out our futons, we drank copious amounts of beer, whiskey, and shochu. Kara did his rendition of Ali Baba. Ree sang something from another play called John Silver, Love in Shinjuku. We all joined in, clapping hands. Nezu played the guitar. We had a friendly argument about the fate of the Palestinians. A toast was made to Iwan the Gaijin. All was well. Communal harmony seemed in perfect order. And yet, there was a little fly in the ointment, a minor source of tension, which I'd been slow to pick up on. Whenever Nezu appeared on stage, a large contingent of teenage girls in the audience started screaming deliriously. This was not the usual sound of appreciation in the red tent. It was more like the swelling shriek of a collective orgasm. At one point, Kara, in his role as the director of the hospital in Shtaya, told the girls to stop making so much noise, while shaking his bamboo stick at them. Rowdy audiences had always been part of the Situation Theatre's neo-kabuki style. Stars were used to being cheered. But the girls screaming at Nezu were not the usual Situation Theatre fans. They were much younger. In fact, they were probably not really Situation Theatre fans at all, but Nezu fans. This might not have mattered so much if Nezu had acquired these fans as one of Kara's star actors. This was not the case, however. Shortly before going on tour with Tale of the Unicorn, Nezu had been cast in a popular television drama, playing a 16th-century outlaw named Ishikawa Goemon, a kind of Japanese Robin Hood. After a failed attempt to kill the most powerful warlord in Japan, Goemon was boiled alive in a cauldron, thus giving his name to a special kind of metal bathtub that is still in use. To enter this tub, one must be careful not to get scalded by the hot metal casing. In any case, Goemon is a glamorous figure, and the Tokyo James Dean was on his way to becoming a national heartthrob. Ree was starring in the same drama, and clearly had an appetite to do more television. Kara had a role in the show himself, but it was a minor part, as a pirate chief. He might have felt a certain wariness and perhaps intimations of disloyalty. I didn't quite realize this at the time when I was singing and clapping along at the Osaka Temple, but I should have known something was amiss when Kara, apropos of what I can't remember, said in a fit of peevishness, "Nezu, you're getting much too slick for your own good." Nezu reacted by keeping his head down, but Ree was not the type to keep her head down. Her public rows with Kara were legendary in the small world of the Tokyo avant-garde. I'd witnessed one or two of these explosions at their house. They were spectacular. Kara puffed up like an enraged bullfrog, Ree screaming her head off, tables of food being overturned. But I was assured that these episodes should be regarded as tokens of their passion for each other. They were like Stanley Kowalski and Stella in A Streetcar Named Desire. Confrontation was the spring of their creative juices. Kara's theater was unthinkable without the presence of Ree, and anyway, people said to me in private, Ree is Korean. Such outbursts are part of her Korean temperament. Next stop, Kumamoto. The tent was raised on the banks of the Shirakawa River, in sight of Kumamoto Castle, a fine, so-called old building, constructed mostly in the 16th and 17th centuries, damaged in the Civil War in the late 19th century, and reconstructed in concrete in the 1960s. As our minibus pulled up near the site, we could hear the by now familiar screeches and yelps from teenage girls in Mickey Mouse t-shirts and pink ankle socks. Kara yelled at them to get out of the way as we got off the bus. I too, perhaps to ingratiate myself with Kara, and partly as a show of fitting in, voiced my annoyance with the teenage groupies. Neza, disguised imperfectly by dark aviator glasses and a baseball cap, said to me in English, "I'm sorry." Riverbanks in Japan were the traditional haunts of outcasts, fairground entertainers, gamblers, petty thieves, travelling players, prostitutes, and other riffraff. The slummy outcast or burakumin areas are often still to be found along the less salubrious urban river banks. Hence the identification of Kara and his troupe with the riverside beggars, who formed the first kabuki troupes in the beginning of the 17th century. The bank of the Shirakawa, where we were busily sticking tent poles into the muddy soil, was swarming with people. This time they were not drag queens or cheap hookers, but students banging on drums, playing trumpets, dancing, making out. In short, doing all the things for which there's little room or opportunity in the cramped confines of Japanese urban life. Two mannish-looking young women with short-cropped hair and thick calves strode up to our tent and introduced themselves as passionate Nezu fans. The couple looked like professional wrestlers. They told us they were employed as guards at a local women's prison. Kara was not terribly pleased to see them, but their friendliness and sheer oddness broke the ice. They handed out boxes of delicious homemade rice balls filled with cod roe and wrapped in blackish-green seaweed. Kara, still in a grumpy mood, was doing his best to accommodate a local television reporter, a fat man in a white suit with chocolate-brown stripes, giving him a passing resemblance to an olive-skinned Fats Domino. But when asked to sum up the play in 5 minutes, with a microphone held under his nose, Kara said no. I don't know how the interview proceeded after that, but about 15 minutes later, I spotted the fat man on his hands and knees, barking at a stage prop of a dog. That was the last we saw of him. The final rehearsal before our first performance in Kumamoto started late in the evening. Kara, in a soft leather jacket, stood in the murky reddish light of the tent, in the hunched position of a boxer, his eyes fixed on the stage, silently mouthing the lines. Kaoru was still suffering from a sore throat. Rain was pelting down outside, creating a muddy delta around the tent, and making such a racket that it was hard to hear what was being said on stage. It was 1 o'clock in the morning by the time we were through, hoarse, hungry, and exhausted. The following day, one of Kara's oldest friends arrived on the scene, a cartoonist and manga artist named Akatsuka Fujio. His manga had become so famous that he was known as the Gag Manga King. Akatsuka had helped to finance the Red Tent. A pale, rather shy man with a boyish fringe of black hair, born in Manchukuo, the son of an officer of the dreaded military police or Kempeitai, Akatsuka needed prodigious amounts of drink to unwind. Once he unwound, he was ready for anything. Araki, the photographer, had done a series of pictures of Akatsuka dressed in a stripy t-shirt, fucking a young woman in a Shinjuku short-time hotel. To celebrate his visit to Kumamoto, Kara cast him as one of the nurses in the Shitaya Hospital. His entrance was rather spectacular, for he swam to the tent in the Shirakawa River before emerging on stage in his drenched nurse's uniform. Perhaps it was the effect of the cold stream, but even though all he needed to do was stand on stage without saying anything, I'd rarely seen anyone look so uncomfortable in the public gaze. He fidgeted about with a haunted look, desperate to dash back into the wings for a welcome glass of beer. There were other famous visitors who came around after the performance. Miwa Akihiro was one, an actor and a cabaret singer. Miwa always dressed as a woman, on stage and off. He was reputed to have been Mishima's lover. They appeared together in the first film I ever saw in Japan, down in a small basement theater in Shinjuku. With a script written by Mishima himself, the movie, entitled Kurotokage, or Black Lizard, 1969, is a perfect amalgam of homoerotic, sadomasochistic Japanese Oscar Wildean kitsch. Miwa plays the Black Lizard, a nightclub owner and criminal mastermind, a femme fatale oozing evil, who falls in love with the young detective working on her case. Mishima appears in the film as a buff gangster, all his bodybuilding efforts on full display, who is murdered by the Black Lizard and turned into a nude sculpture for her to play with in her nightclub. Astonishingly, this morbid fantasy was first produced as a musical in 1962. Mishima, apparently, preferred the later version starring Miwa. Miwa spoke highly effeminate Japanese in a growling masculine voice. He claimed to be the incarnation of a pretty adolescent boy who led a 17th-century rebellion by Christian peasants against the samurai rulers in southern Kyushu. The rebellion ended with a massacre of all the local Christians. The boy's head was displayed on a pike in Nagasaki, Miwa's native town. I'd been introduced to Miwa once before, in a Ginza nightclub where he sang French chansons à la Edith Piaf. I found him rather terrifying. The reaction of such visitors to my presence was usually something like, "My, my, look at how international the Situation Theatre has become these days." Sometimes, too, I would be pumped with questions about life in the United States, as if I knew. Under sufficient provocation, I would respond by putting on my supercilious Japanese act to the point, almost, of imitating Kara's Shitamachi accent. I must have been insufferable, not to say inscrutable. But in fact, none of these remarks by the distinguished visitors were meant to provoke. I suppose what irked me was the reminder of my uncertain status in the group. One of the gang, privileged gaijin, international mascot, or spy. Perhaps it was the presence of Miwa that affected my concentration. But the second night in Kumamoto was a minor disaster. I got to the bit about being the midnight cowboy all right, but then suddenly my mind blanked. I saw Kaoru wait for my next line with a slight nervous twitch in the corner of his mouth. Panic struck, my throat went dry, sweat stung in my eyes, and I could sense the audience wondering what was wrong. It was like being sucked into a void. The harder my heart thumped in my chest, the more the words escaped me. I did not have the professional skill to cover up and improvise until I calmed down. After long, endless, mortifying seconds had gone by, Kaoru audibly fed me my next line. It didn't happen again, but it was petrifying while it lasted. And worse, Kara was deeply annoyed. We left Kumamoto in the minibus at dawn. Mist still clung to the road like shreds of gauze. Minutes later, we left the minor road to enter the highway heading north. There, on the corner, stood the two female prison guards, frantically waving their handkerchiefs. God knows how long they'd been waiting to catch a glimpse of us, or Nezu, in the early morning. Most of us waved back. The riverbed of the Kamogawa in Kyoto is in a way a hallowed space, for that is where the Kabuki Theater began. Around 1603, a former Shinto shrine dancer named Izumo no Okuni gathered a number of outcasts and prostitutes to form an all-female acting troupe. They danced on the dry riverbed and performed sketches of love trysts in the Kyoto brothels. The style caught on, not least in the pleasure quarter itself. A decade or so later, the authorities, in one of their periodic efforts to crack down on public lewdness and uncontrolled prostitution, banned performances by female actors. So young men took over and played the female roles. Apparently this did nothing to diminish the appetite for paying actors to have sex. So in due course, young men were banned from the stage as well, unless they shaved their pates in the adult fashion. And thus a great theatrical tradition was born that continues in a somewhat fossilized state today. One of the most moving performances I've ever seen in any theater was in Osaka, of a famous scene where a young samurai is forced to sell his wife to a brothel in Kyoto to raise money for a vendetta against a wicked courtier who'd forced the young man's lord to slit his belly. An up-and-coming actor played the role of the young samurai. His own father, the venerable Nakamura Ganjiro, then in his 80s, played his young wife. But I suppose this was no stranger than seeing Montserrat Caballé, also in Osaka a few years later, sing Tosca when she was far too bulky to jump off the wall that was no higher than a shoebox. There, more or less on the same spot where Izumo no Okuni once danced, the red tent went up for the final performances before returning to Tokyo. We stayed in the same old student dorm where I'd been with Maro's Dairakudakan troupe. On the night before the opening show, Kara, along with some of the main players and myself, ever the privileged gaijin, were taken out for dinner in Pontocho, an ancient district of cobbled streets and narrow alleys where Kyoto geisha flit in and out of graceful wooden and bamboo tea houses. On the river bank there's now a rather hideous statue of a very respectable, even demure-looking okuni, doing a kind of sword dance. Our host was a well-known surrealist poet, whose name now escapes me. We sat in a row at the cypress wood counter of an exclusive Japanese restaurant, where the raw fish was so fresh that some morsels were still twitching on the pretty porcelain dishes. One man, not in our group, was poking a trembling prawn with his chopstick. The prawn was dead and could not have suffered, but there was an element of sadism about the scene that still sticks in my mind. The discussion on surrealism in Japan was fascinating and well over my head. Kara talked about André Breton and about Nanai Kafu, the literary flaneur and keen visitor of Asakusa strip theatres, who was found dead in his study with breadcrumbs all over his suit. At some point in the evening, I thought it would be amusing to tell the distinguished poet about our encounters with Nezu's screaming devotees. This was followed by an unamused silence. I asked Kaoru later whether I'd made a gaffe. "Well," he said, "we all know what you said was true, but we don't necessarily have to spell it out, do we?" Our final performance in Kyoto was a triumph. It was a warm night. The Kamogawa, shimmering with reflected neon lights, never looked more beautiful. The audience was loud and appreciative, and the hardcore Nezu fans were not much in evidence. After we'd scrubbed off our makeup, Ree left us to have dinner with a friend somewhere in town. The rest of us followed Kara into the minibus to celebrate our last night in an old Kyoto restaurant, where sword marks from boisterous 19th-century samurai could still be seen on the blackened wood of the entrance hall. A sumptuous dinner of traditional Kyoto cuisine was waiting for us in a large room on the second floor, where we sat down on silk cushions on an olive-coloured tatami floor. In one corner of the room was a scroll painting of a Zen monk suspended above a lovely iris flower arrangement. This time, we had another guest in our midst. I recognized him instantly as a minor star in the Yakuza movies. His name was Kawatani Takuzo, whose main role in gangster pictures was to pull fearsome faces and die, always in a violent manner, rather early on in the story. Kawatani was in fact a ham, cast more for his peculiar looks than his acting skills. His eyebrows met in a thick black line across his shifty little eyes, lending an air of dumb brutality to a man who seemed perfectly amiable off-screen. He had come to see our play out of deference to Ree. They had starred together in a successful TV drama. I wasn't paying much attention to Kawatani, who was sitting next to Kara. I was at the other end of a long table. It is possible that Kawatani had already had a few drinks before he arrived at the restaurant, but he didn't look particularly the worse for wear. But soon I sensed the beginning of an altercation with Kara. I wasn't close enough to see what started it. Later, I was told that Kawatani had been needling Kara in a particularly sore spot. The theater was old hat, he supposedly claimed. Kara was wasting his time. He should be doing more television or movies like Ree. And so, apparently, it went on for a while, until Kara suddenly made his move. He lurched toward his guest. The gangster actor's face was drenched in beer, and Kara started furiously pummeling him with his fists. This was the sign for others to join the fray. For a short while, Kawatani was buried under a group of actors, showing their solidarity by furiously pounding the small writhing figure on the tatami, lightly sprinkled by splashes of blood. Once he emerged from the scrum, it was clear that Kawatani's face was a mess. A phone call was quickly made and he was removed from the premises on a stretcher. I was speechless, as usual, in scenes of actual violence. More than anything, it was the mob behavior of my fellow actors that shook me. Once again, I felt I was out of step with the group, like when I was absorbed in David Copperfield on the way to Osaka. I can't remember what was said after the fight. The evening is a blank until an hour or so later, when Ree finally turned up. She had heard what had happened and was in a howling rage. Standing in the middle of the room, she wagged her finger at Kara, who was still sitting on the floor, and started screaming at him. What did he think he was doing? How dare he attack her friend and colleague in this manner? Who did he think he was? Kara's face went a darker red. He cursed his wife, grabbed a heavy ashtray like a glass brick, and flung it at her. Missing her head by inches, the ashtray shattered the wall covered in elegant rice paper paneling. I was so stunned that I didn't really know what I was doing, but I remember getting to my feet and blurting out to Kara something absurd like, "You can't do that to a woman." There was a moment of baffled silence around the room. Kara could not believe what he was hearing. His furious eyes swiveled in my direction. His voice dropped to a menacing growl like a dangerous animal under threat. "How dare you speak to me like that?" I still don't know why I did it. What possessed me to humiliate Kara in this way in front of his actors? I should have known better than to interfere in a fight between husband and wife. What was behind this pompous gesture of chivalry? Could it have had something to do with my shaky sense of self in the midst of a Japanese theater troupe? Was it a displaced cry to be seen for who I really was? Did I even know myself? But I shall never forget Kara's words, repeated in unabated anger in the bus on our way back to the dormitory. "So you're just an ordinary gaijin after all." Chapter 10. "Ah," said Kara with a crooked smile, "I can see the whiteys already." He used the word keto, literally hairy foreigner, a derogatory term used only for white people, even though the to refers to China, which in the olden days stood for the outside world. Kara was in a cheerful mood. We were entering one of the terminals of the brand new Narita International Airport, still surrounded by high fences, numerous checkpoints, and thousands of security police milling around among Japanese and keto, checking in. The construction of Narita on expropriated village land had been the last focal point of Japanese mass protest in the 20th century. Before Narita was officially opened, left-wing protesters had managed to take over the control tower. 6,000 demonstrators tried to disrupt the official opening. A Japanese newscaster compared the place to the Saigon airport during the Vietnam War. We were soon to be on our way to New York, the first time Kara and Ree would set foot in a Western country. This was in the late summer of 1978, about 3 months after the ashtray-throwing incident in Kyoto. It had not been an easy time. Kara was still smarting from my insulting behavior. My enthusiasm for performing Iwan the Gaijin was waning, but we were still roped together as the Tokyo leg of the tour had to be completed. The tent was set up near the railway siding in Ikebukuro. We played to full houses on most nights. Relations did not improve when my article about our adventures with the Situation Theatre appeared in the Asahi magazine. They'd given it a good spread. I thought my color photographs looked fine. I'd written what I thought was a friendly piece about the effect of a traveling theater troupe on its surroundings, how the red tent created an atmosphere of drama wherever it was pitched. I described the female prison wardens in Kumamoto and the swordsmen in Osaka. I mentioned Kara's tense encounters with Nez's screaming fans. I'd reached for a tone that was sympathetic and, I thought, funny. But I'm afraid it was not received in that spirit. On the contrary, it further fanned the flames of Kara's rage. Perhaps this was partly a matter of language. Irony does not translate well into Japanese. It can easily come across as sarcasm. But I think something else was the matter, too. I'd failed to write as an insider. Having been offered the chance to take my place in the gang as an honorary member, I had described the troop with an air of detachment. This distancing was perhaps regarded as hostile. I had learned an important lesson about writing. When you turn friends into characters or figures in a landscape, you run the danger of causing offense, because the way you see them, however well-intentioned, may not be the way they see themselves. And who wants to be a figure in a landscape anyway? I think that was at least part of the problem. Kara never gave me a detailed critique. All he said after a long and angry sulk was, "Iwan, you are," and here he used the English phrase, "a cynical guy." Still, all seemed to be forgotten near the end of the season, when the famous Romanian-American theatre director Andre Sherbun turned up in the tent one night. Sherbun, a tall, blonde, somewhat Christ-like figure, had left his native Bucharest in 1969 for New York. He had directed a controversial Medea at Ellen Stewart's La Mama Experimental Theatre Club. Later, he did a number of Chekhov plays, starring Meryl Streep and F. Murray Abraham, upsetting some conventional critics with his idiosyncratic interpretations. He once said that Broadway producers wouldn't go near him, since he was known as the director who destroys the classics. Sherbun was thrilled by Tale of the Unicorn. "It's like Commedia dell'arte," he exclaimed after the performance back in Kara's studio. "It is like kabuki. It is the essence of theatre." I translated. Kara was all smiles, making sure our glasses of whiskey were kept full. Sherbun told Kara he had to come to New York. People there had never seen anything like the Situation Theatre. They would love it. Kara's eyes took on a dreamy expression. "To put up the tent in Central Park, now that would really be something." "Yes," cried Sherbun, "Central Park, the red tent will arise in Central Park." And that is how we ended up at Narita International Airport, bound for New York. I don't know how much Andre Sherbun had to do with the organization. Various foundations and cultural councils had been involved. I was to accompany Kara and Ri as their translator and guide. Mine was not a paid job, but more something done in the spirit of friendship. This is the way many things worked in Japan. Mutual obligations are built up over time and not always expressed in cash. I'd been to New York only once before in my life, but I was happy to guide my Japanese friends in the Keto Labyrinth. Kara peered into the night from the airplane window as New York City twinkled below us like a vast blanket of fairy lights, turned his head away in a gesture of disdain, and said, "Seoul is really much more impressive, isn't it?" I'd booked us into the Chelsea Hotel because I'd read in some magazine that it was a hip place to be. Andy Warhol had shot a movie there. Jane Fonda and Jimi Hendrix had been residents. When we checked in, a painfully thin man in a tattered black top hat and a white woman's petticoat was nodding off in the lobby. The rooms were so seedy that fat slugs left slimy traces on the stained carpets full of cigarette burns. A reek of marijuana and bad plumbing hung in the halls. I thought this would be the perfect place to start Kara's journey to the West. In a memoir written some years later, Kara described the hotel as ikagawashi, meaning dubious, suspicious, or unseemly. The reason for coming to New York was, of course, to meet people and see plays. My memory of the meetings is now a blur. I do recall Ellen Stewart at La Mama. Her splendid cornrows had not yet gone silver. It was a hot Saturday afternoon in the East Village. A block party had turned the street over to a mass of people dancing to the sounds of Bob Marley. She told us how the whole world was coming together right there in the village. They'd staged a Korean Hamlet at La Mama a year before. "Child," Stewart said, "if a play beeps to me, I'll put it on." The array of armbands and bracelets that ringed her thin brown arms made a pleasant clinking sound as she sashayed her way down the block, greeting neighbors like the Queen of East 4th Street. We saw Joe Papp at the Public Theatre, who, after being introduced to Kara Judo and Ri Reisen of the Red Tent Theatre, greeted them as Mr. and Mrs. Red Tent. Even though Kara had criticized me the night before for not translating every word that the man from the Rockefeller Foundation had spoken, I decided that Papp's condescension could do without a translation. Pap looked preoccupied, sitting behind his desk, with frequent glances at his watch. "Well," he said, "yes, a theatre tent in Central Park, yes, that sure could be interesting." We saw the incomparable Charles Ludlam perform in an impossibly camp version of The Lady of the Camellias. He acted as the lady, of course, in a tiny former gay nightclub on Sheridan Square. We went to Central Park to see Meryl Streep and Raoul Julia perform in The Taming of the Shrew. Andre Sherbin was with us, bubbling with enthusiasm. "Keep an eye on that young Streep," he said. "She's going to be a big star." We even went up to a disused parking lot in Harlem one night, where a group of socially engaged black actors were entertaining the neighborhood people for free. We were told by whoever it was that sent us up there which streets to avoid. Harlem was still an edgy place back then. I can't remember what else we saw, but Kara and Ree were remarkably blasé about the theatre in New York. Even Ludlam's wild antics left them rather cold. I think they found American acting too cerebral, not physical enough. Ree observed that Americans didn't, as she put it, act with their lower bodies. An aspiring young performer belting out a show tune to the crowd queuing up in front of a Broadway theater left a greater impression on them than Streep, Ludlam, or Julia. Kara in particular appeared not to be excited by anything much. He was oddly incurious about a city he'd never visited before. When Ree suggested going to one of the great museums, Kara said rather curtly that he would stay in the hotel. "Do you really think," he said, "Andre Sherbin would be going to museums in Tokyo?" One thing Kara did observe was something that would not have surprised any New Yorkers. The streets were full of panhandlers at the time, ragged people sprawled on park benches or emaciated junkies in subway tunnels or in the lobbies of crumbling apartment buildings. What struck Kara, however, was not the number of down-and-outs, but the fact that so many of them were white. The sight of a poor begging keto was an anomaly to him, something almost against nature. He expressed no satisfaction in this, just a sense of wonderment. A year before, in the summer of Sam, a serial killer claiming to have heard the voice of a demon dog in his head had gunned down strangers at random in the outer boroughs of New York. I can't remember who suggested going on a tour of the murder sites, but there we were in a taxi, prowling obscure bits of Queens and the Bronx, with a knowledgeable cab driver filling us in on the precise details of the killings. Mostly, however, Kara stayed in the hotel, writing his next play, while Ree and I went for walks or to the movies. We saw Faye Dunaway in a mediocre picture called Eyes of Laura Mars, playing a fashion photographer being stalked in New York by a serial killer. Kara's decision to shut himself off in his hotel room might have been a form of posturing, an effort to do as he thought Andre Sherbin would have done in Japan. Or perhaps it was a form of shyness. I had read accounts of other famous Japanese artists and writers who reacted defensively to being in a strange Western city, unrecognized among strangers. Sudden obscurity could be painful to grand men who were used to deference, even adulation, at home. Mishima, I had been told, found this particularly irksome. He spent his first time in New York in an almost constant huff. Indifference was sometimes rather too quickly interpreted as racial prejudice. In 1965, Oe Kenzaburo, who would later win the Nobel Prize for Literature, sent a postcard to his translator from New York. "A few days ago, I was introduced to Norman Mailer at a bar late at night. He ignored me as if I were a small dog, or maybe a visiting dentist from an undeveloped country. Alas!" The pride of local fame, however, is not the only possible explanation. The great Natsume Soseki almost went mad with solitude during his 2 years of studying in London. He wrote about that unhappy time, much of it spent in the seclusion of his lodgings in South London. "Everyone I see on the street is tall and good-looking. That, first of all, intimidates me, embarrasses me. Sometimes I see an unusually short man, but he is still 2 inches taller than I am. Then I see a dwarf coming, a man with an unpleasant complexion, and he happens to be my own reflection in the shop window." But this was in 1903, some years before Soseki became the most famous novelist in Japan. Then there is the so-called Paris syndrome, a phrase coined by the press at the end of the 20th century to describe Japanese tourists whose first encounter with Paris, or any other Western city idealized from afar, made them go slightly mad, so they would have to be repatriated. Something like that happened to a pale, bookish Japanese student called Sagawa Ise, who spent almost 4 years studying French without much success. In the early summer of 1981, he lured a beautiful Dutch student called René Hartefeldt, who spoke fluent French, to his apartment with an excuse about wanting her to read a German poem. Sagawa, then 32 years old, had a peculiar history with white women. He had assaulted a German woman in Tokyo 10 years before. Something he wrote about his life in Paris echoed Soseki's sentiments in a strange way. "Sitting in a cafe one day," he wrote, "suddenly I looked at the glass front door of the cafe and reflected there were the five of us. A small Oriental in a charcoal blazer was submerged amid large white-skinned men and women. Instinctively I looked away." On that ill-fated day in June, in Sagawa's apartment, René Hartefeldt turned around to read the German poem, and Sagawa shot her in the back with a rifle. He raped her corpse, sliced her up in pieces, ate some parts, and kept some in his refrigerator before packing up the remains in a suitcase, which he tried to dump in the Bois de Boulogne, alas for him, in full sight of some French cops. While locked up in a French mental institution, Sagawa became a kind of cult anti-hero in Japan, where writers and intellectuals wrote about him with an appalled, and often appalling, fascination for the ultimate taboo-breaking sex crime. Unwilling to keep him any longer, the French authorities sent Sagawa back to Japan a few years later, where he was examined in the mental hospital and declared sane. Since he had never been officially convicted, he was now free to appear on television talk shows and even play a small part as a sex murderer in a porno movie. Oshima Nagisa was interested in making a film about the case, and so was Kara. Nothing came of these plans, but Kara wrote a novel in 1982 entitled Letters from Sagawa about his semi-fictional attempt to meet the killer in Paris. It was a morbidly playful book, full of references to Keto, to the impossibility of translation, and to the neurotic attitudes of Japanese toward white foreigners. He wrote, "That yearning for the skin of white people, which for long years tormented and drove you on, is not something that I, who have myself been looked down upon by women of foreign parts, cannot understand." In 1983, Kara won the most prestigious Japanese literary prize for his book. To interpret Kara's behavior in New York in hindsight, through the lens of his strange novel, would be unfair. I saw no evidence that Kara's amour-propre was bruised by New York. But he did write some years later that the American trip had made him reflect more deeply on his own background. He felt the need to, as he put it, maintain the balance of his Japanese-ness by writing a play called Kappa, full of references to the muddiest aspects of Japanese culture. The Kappa is a sprite in Japanese myths, a demonic trickster lurking in rivers and lakes. But the Kappa in Kara's play is the reincarnation of a drowned boy living in a tatami room that turns into a bog. And so it goes on, deep into Kara's fantasy world, taking him away from unfamiliar New York back to the swampy soil of Tokyo. Our return flight to Japan was cancelled for a reason I've forgotten, something to do with the weather perhaps. So we had to make a stop in San Francisco, where we spent the day wandering around rather listlessly. After Ree returned to the hotel for a rest, Kara and I ended up in a run-down old theater in Chinatown. We arrived in the middle of a crude and very noisy Cantonese opera. Next to us, an old man was snoring through the crashing, banging, and wailing sounds on stage. Others cleared their throats and spat on the floor just as a young nobleman was declaring his love to a courtesan. We were the only non-Chinese, so far as I could make out. And I was the only Keto. I followed Kara's gaze, as I'd been doing metaphorically all through our trip. I wanted to see what he saw. Kara was less interested in the stage action than in the ambiance, the colored lights beaming in from the back of the theater, the comings and goings of the musicians. It was the first time that week that I'd seen him looking entirely relaxed. After a meal of Chinese noodles, we walked into a random, dimly lit bar. A rather hideous bunch of dusty plastic flowers was arranged on the bar top. Next to it was a large golden cat,